Then I said, I'm from the University of Kentucky, and my background is soil physics. So this morning, I am glad to talk to you about determining spatial and temporal processes from georeference sampling and land surface observations. And the examples that I'm using that will illustrate what I have to say, they will be in some parts derived a little bit from soil physics, but I hope that I'm able to make the point clear that the concepts are very relevant for forage sciences as well. So I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, Greg Schwab, Jason Warden, and Scott Flynn. And again, I'm very happy to talk in evaluating grasslands with remote sensing and georeference techniques. The main questions that we address when we deal with observations that we take across landscapes are, for example, how can we evaluate soil-water plant relations and their impact on physical and biogeochemical processes? Another question could be, how can we take use of modern measurement techniques and of the inherent variability of forage land to improve understanding of forage systems? And as I understand, Dennis, those were some of the motivations that made him to organize this symposium. As forage ecologists, similar to soil scientists, you may be interested in designing schemes to evaluate grassland. And you are tempted to conduct research trials with ecological indicators. And the main goal is to classify a landscape, to classify an area, and subdivide it into different subunits. For many experiments, the usual question is, then, if I impose a treatment in my experimental field, does this treatment cause a significant perturbation from the expected mean? And the usual way is to put out a randomized plot experiment to observe some response of yield versus a fertilizer input, and then do the same experiment at a larger scale or repeat it in other years. And that is often the end of the study, and what are we going to do with the experiments then? The objective of this type of experimental design is to minimize the impact of spatial heterogeneity in field soils and to enhance the efficiency of classical analysis of variance, which has been developed about almost 100 years, 80, 90 years ago by Ronald Fisher. And the underlying assumptions of those experiments are that observations are spatially independent of each other and that the mean is based on normally distributed observations. In theory, we derive our conclusions then from a general mean of the experiment, here denoted by the blue axis. And for every treatment, we observe a certain class deviation. And we hope that that class deviation is somewhat statistically significantly different from the mean overall. If we go back to these concepts, we have to ask ourselves, what if Ronald Fisher, who designed these analytical techniques, if he had had a GPS, a GIS, even a PC? What had he done if he had had a laser scanner, a spectrometer, a yield monitor, a leaf area index measurement instrument, data loggers, and you may add dozens of other fancy techniques that we have in our hands? We have them. But we have to critically ask ourselves, what are we doing with these techniques? I think for a wide range of applications, we do not change the concept of considering treatments and their significant perturbation from the mean. I think we are rather tempted to apply the new techniques, but still ask the same question. What kind of perturbation from the overall mean does a treatment cause? We still use the same statistical methods that were designed 85 years ago by Fisher, when only paper, pencil, and abacus were available. And we talk about improving the environment, raising agricultural production, and solving environmental problems. However, we still do not know, or we do not practice, how to quantitatively make assessments across the landscape. If you want to do that, or in order to do that, I want to go a little bit deeper into temporal and spatial processes. That's the main purpose of my talk. I want to illustrate how we can sample a process and what is important when we design an experiment, and what we can do in order to analyze results without any treatment data. As forage ecologists, you may be well aware of a function like this. This is a typical time series. And many of you might have measured something like this in your own experimental fields. The typical question is, how can we derive process understanding from observations that are taken in time? And here, on the left axis, we see carbon respiration rate, and the blue symbols manifest that carbon respiration rate measured over a time of about 33 days. And underlying as a causing effect is soil temperature measured at 5 centimeter depth. And you can well see the sinusoidal pattern of the soil temperature, and you can see how that coincides with carbon respiration. Now, if we use time series analysis, we then can derive a physical response. So we can describe respiration as a function of soil temperature and water content. And that expression is given here for the carbon respiration status as a function of soil temperature at 5 centimeters and soil water content in the upper soil layer. So we can derive kinetic coefficients from time series analysis depending on the equation that we underlie the time series analysis. Where are time series techniques relevant in our daily life? The time series analysis was developed in the 50s and 60s, and one of the first uses of it was speech identification, filtering of noise. Nowadays, it is used for remote control of vehicles. If you use your device to find a point in the field, your scout to go to a certain point in the field, everything is driven by Kalman filter techniques that help you to find that point as soon as possible. Aircraft steering control, all is based on time series analysis. Medical doctors use time series analysis for diagnosing disease phenomena. Economists use time series analysis, or not at least, weather forecast is all based on statistical time series analysis. If you look at this curve, a typical curve for body temperature during an infectious disease, you can see that once the infection took place, the temperature raises and it stays high until either a medication or the immune system of the body has fought down the infection, and then the temperature goes down again. So would you ask yourself, if you see this series of data, is the average of that data series anyhow meaningful? No way. Would you, in fact, tend to randomize these individual points? Of course not, because only the sequence of the points gives you the process of what is going on. Would you pay a lot of attention to an individual temperature value? No way. You want to know what is this individual temperature value in relation to what I observed before. That way you know if the temperature is raising, that's an alarming signal, or if the temperature is going down, which is kind of a relief. We use this kind of analysis in soil physics when we try to determine very important soil physical characteristics in the field. For example, we determine the hydraulic conductivity function, one of the most relevant ecological soil functions we have, by taking measurements and observing. This is a soil compartment between depths Zi and Zi plus 1. We measure the flux into this compartment, we measure the flux out of that compartment, and we measure the water content or water storage change in this compartment, and we measure the driving force, the hydraulic gradient, across the boundary of that compartment. This is done usually in internal drainage experiments, as an example. So we have to know boundary conditions for every compartment. We apply a physical equation, which is this one, which describes it is the continuity equation, and we measure time series of the relevant state variables, like the soil water content and the hydraulic gradient developed in time, and then the result is a derived physical property function, the hydraulic conductivity as a function of soil water content. And this can be further parameterized and used in transport models, or can go into soil databases. And the two empirical coefficients A and B describe the shape of the curve. I tried to think of what kind of time series analysis may be relevant for forage ecosystems. And some thoughts I got was, for example, plant growth rate in relation to rhizosphere moisture and air temperature. Another set of data that could be taken to describe microbial respiration and its association to time series of soil water content and surface temperature. Or we may be interested in the seasonal change of soil water infiltration behavior, and as it is affected by plant surface cover, soil structural status, and biological activity. And you may add a lot of other relevant topics, and I'm sure I do not capture at least half of ideas that we might compile in a discussion here. The point I want to make here is, and why I focus so much on time series, is that we have to follow the same idea that we naturally apply to the analysis of time series. See, astonishingly, nobody in the room would easily argue for randomizing observations that are taken in time, as we understand that the randomization would remove the relevant features of the process and prohibits its diagnosis. Randomizing that Fieber curve would not help us. Randomizing those soil water content data would take away just the important feature of what we want to find out. We do so still when we do spatial analysis. We tend to randomize in order to be objective, to be unbiased, but I think that approach has to be rethought. We can examine spatial processes in a different way. And process, the original Latin word procedere, that term was used in a spatial context to move on, to move forward. We do not only understand processes as a change of system in time, but we can also examine processes as we move through space. And we do then not have to base our interpretation and conclusion upon average, mean, or bulk values, but we can diagnose a system based on the continuity of observations. How do we sample a process? First of all, we have to consider, and that is where your disciplinary knowledge becomes very important, the variable that you want to measure. What is the sample volume of that? What is the typical volume that you are going to take, and is it one big sample, or is it several small samples that you average into one bulk sample at every location? That is the sample support. Also, the sample spacing is a very important criterion that you have to consider. And as my teacher, Don Nielsen, said, there's no free lunch. You have to go out and collect experience and find out how close you have to sample. And also the domain or the extent, so the overall size of area is very important over which you conduct your study. Those things need to be considered seriously, and there's often no a priori answer about the right way to go. We also often worry about what is the representative elementary volume, or what is the mean and the variances change with sampling volume. And I want to illustrate that here with an example from Kutilek and Nielsen's book Soil Hydrology. Let us consider here a very tiny, tiny soil image where we that consists with the gray zones, that's solid particles, and light zones, that's pore space. And we want to estimate the total volume of pores. First, we want to start with a very small scale, the VT1, these red squares that you can see here. And depending on where we put this square, the answer may be the pore space is 100%, or if we put it here into the solid phase, the answer is 0%. If we go to the next size square, the blue squares, the answer changes. So the total volume of pores is in this case 72%, and in that case, for the dashed line square, it is 33%. If we keep increasing the volume of consideration, both values, both squares provide a more and more similar answer. So for the green line surrounded square, we have a porosity of almost 50%, and in that case it is 40%, so very close. From a different perspective, with increasing volume of our sample, we decrease the difference in the answer that we may obtain from individual samples until they converge relative to each other. And at the point where there's no difference in the answer, we have reached the representative elementary volume, which is the smallest volume at which mean and probably variance are constant. However, in many cases, we do not want to sample at a size of the representative volume because that's too large. We are interested in the variance and in the process that occurs at a smaller scale. So we have to know about the representativity at smaller volumes or smaller scales. In order to do that, I want to illustrate here a data set that we sampled across a moraine landscape, a transect of 500 meter length, and we measured soil water content, which is manifested here at the with the blue symbols across that transect at different layers. Here the data are presented for the surface soil. And what we want to do here stepwise is we want to see how does the answer change if we change the sampling distance, so the spacing between samples, and how does it change if we not only change the distance but also the aggregation volume. And the relevance of that question of how does the aggregation volume change the answer, you may think, you may consider an aggregated, so an over a larger area averaged soil water content as a number that you may obtain from a remote sensor, from a satellite image, where the smallest pixel size is perhaps 30 by 30 meters or 50 by 50 meters. So when we look at these aggregated data and the aggregated information, we should not forget what happens at the scale below. So the question is, how do sampling distance and aggregation affect the result? And you can see in this second graph how are individual point measurements, or how is the feature of individual point measurements changing, and you can see already the smoothing effect from these square symbols that occurs when we aggregate over a fairly large volume, over 25 meters. And here the next higher aggregation step is over 55 meters. So not only spacing, that's for the closed symbols, but also aggregation occurs. The questions that we can answer with that analysis are, how does the size of an individual sample affect the result, and how does the aggregation volume affect the result? In terms of spacing, how does the separation distance affect the result? Or in terms of domain, or the overall size of the area that we investigate, how does the size of the considered domain or the extent affect the result? And even further, if we want to walk across different scales, how does the information change if we go from one scale level to another? In this figure, I want to show the mean and the variance behavior of point and aggregated measurements of soil water content. So how does the information change of the mean if we increase the sampling distance, which is shown here by these solid blue symbols. And the associated standard deviation or variance is shown with the solid red symbols here. And the data, the values are at the right-hand axis, y-axis. We can conclude from this graph that with increasing sampling distance, the variance increases while the mean varies irregularly for the point observations. For the aggregated observations taken over the same distance, we can say that with increasing aggregation volume, the variance decreases, so the completely opposite picture, while the mean remains relatively stable. And we have to ask ourselves, if this mean remains relatively stable, what kind of information do we lose? And it's not only for the univariate consideration of soil water content, but it is also relevant for relations between different variables. Here in this case, I show rank correlation coefficients between soil water content and elevation data. So you can see that for the point observations, the rank correlation fluctuates considerably, whereas for aggregated data with increasing aggregation volume and sampling distance, the rank correlation coefficient becomes tighter, so there's a stronger negative relation between both variables. And so that is also the case for soil water content versus sand content, and even soil water content versus at shallow layers versus soil water content at deeper layers. Another result that we have to draw if we analyze data in this way is we use the same underlying data base and we calculate regression relations between soil sand content and soil water content, sand content plotted at the x-axis, and we plot for different data aggregation levels and sampling distances, we plot regression lines, we get a huge variation between these regression lines for aggregated but also for point measurements. That's a really frightening result. You want to draw a conclusion, and depending on the scale, that relation completely changes. You may have made that same experience if you have to, for your local state, you have to draw a relation between soil type and yield potential all over the state. You may find a close relationship. If you go to an individual farmer's field and you try to put points for that relationship within that farmer's field, you may find something completely different. So the information change from one scale to another scale is drastic, and we should not, which is manifested by these results, should not too quickly apply relationships that were derived at a larger scale to smaller scales. The different regression relationships strongly depend on sampling distance and support size. What can we do instead? We can instead analyze spatial or temporal variance. And the assumption of spatial or temporal independence is then unnecessary. We can distinguish between structured and random variation, and we base our diagnosis on structured variation. One important aspect is we want to determine the spatial range of representativity. We can do that easily by variogram analysis, and many of you are aware of it. So what a variogram is, basically, it is a plot of differences in the magnitude between neighboring observations that belong to the same neighboring distance class that is called lag. And we do these difference calculations for different lag classes, and so the variance increases up to a level where we approach about the total population variance. the point at the lag distance at which we approach this random variance is called the lag, the range of spatial correlation. That is the spatial range. Up until this distance, observations are more similar to each other than taken over longer distances. And if we do that for the water content data that I just showed, the original data variogram as shown here in the black dots, we can see for the point measurements taken over 15 meters, the original semi-variogram is somewhat conserved. However, if we use aggregated data, we can see already the effect of the aggregation. The variance is reduced down to about 60%, so quite a bit of information is taken out. That's what we get from a remote sensing image, and that is what we should consider if we decide we need to go to a finer measurement resolution, or that is what we have to know when we decide we want to stick with that resolution because we want to do something still on a larger scale. If we further increase the distance between point or aggregated measurements, we obtain less structured variogram indications until we obtain random variation. This type of a semi-variogram reflects ideal conditions for a Fisher type of analysis of variance. Now we have to ask ourselves, if we do field experiments, do our observations show that random variability structure, or do they in fact show structure? The questions I want to derive here so far for potential research opportunities would be probably not only regarding soil water content, but important forage state variables. At what spatial resolution do we have to take measurements in space and time? How many point observations of theta do we have to take in order to find one spatial relation to a remotely sensed pixel, so to an aggregated measure for calibration purposes? How often are observations needed in time for calculating fluxes, so changes in time? And how are observations from the land surface related to processes at soil depths? You may have probably observed a lot of changes going on at the land surface in forage systems and made some conclusions about what is going on at greater depths. For us at soil physicists, a relevant application could be that we look at these soil water content data down to 20 centimeter depth, and we relate that to total water storage between 20 and 80 centimeter depth, and then run a spatial analysis and describe this in a state space autoregressive model. And we can describe the process of storage in the field nicely, even with only a few locations measured. The confidence intervals manifested here in the gray shaded area are still promising. So land surface observations can well reflect spatial processes that happen at greater soil depths or integrate processes over greater soil depths. Next, I want to talk about our always beloved child, nitrogen fertilizer response. We did a study this year in wheat, and I'm sure that many of you do these studies in grassland ecosystems. Well, of course, we want to see what our main impact factor, our main production factor causes. We did a field experiment in the Gilkey farm in western Kentucky in Princeton, and we applied 6 levels of nitrogen. Practical rates, and the plot size was 15 by 27 meters, and we had 4 to 9 replicates per treatment. The main question wanted to examine the impact of nitrogen fertilizer on wheat yield from a randomized design. Here's the result. Splendid. We get a response to grain yield depending on our nitrogen application. Well, we didn't look at how much nitrogen was already in the soil and what was going on. So just the typical simple approach. Now let's look at how much these data are worth. These are the 95% confidence limits of these mean values. It's a drama. I was frustrated seeing that. Then I conducted the ANOVA. I got out my old statistics book and plugged in these numbers, and I was even more frustrated. F calculated 2.47, F table 2.45, huh, all work was in vain. Impact of nitrogen application rate on wheat yield is almost insignificant. I couldn't believe it. What to tell the farmer? What to tell my boss? So another set of results going just into the drawer. Well, wait a minute. Let's look at it from a different perspective. Remember, we had 42 plots, and here, well, in fact, we did not apply the nitrogen spatially randomly, but we used a sinusoidal pattern. That was not my idea. Fox, in 1972, 35 years ago, did that at the University of Hawaii. He applied nitrogen in a continuous manner across a landscape with an increasing and decreasing rate. Never got credit for it, could only publish it in an internal paper, and he was accused of violating all good knowledge about statistics. So he got a response, but that is, and I couldn't even get a copy of the original paper, although I tried hard. So the design of our experiment here was, we had the strip in a farmer's field, which he didn't care, he did not kill, although there was some frost damage, but he left the strip for us. And 42 plots, 27 by 15 meters, not randomly, but systematically distributed. So these are the nitrogen rates that we brought out in the field. Sinusoidal pattern of nitrogen application rate. Now the wheat yield data. This is the wheat yield, how it varied. So maybe not always right on the spot, but we can nicely follow the sinusoidal pattern here and also here in this field. Just this medium sine wave did not cause the response that we were expecting. Nevertheless, we can see that there's a general trend in the data. So the local minima were higher up here, and the local maxima were also higher up here in this part of the field, left part of the field, than in the right-hand side of the field, where the local minima went way down and local maxima did not yield quite as high as they did in the first part of the field. We also took green seeker measurements for calculating the NDVI. And these measurements, wheat yield and green seeker, were aggregated over a measurement over a width of 27 by 10 meters. Thousands of Greenseeker NDVI data are in each of these triangular points, and about 50 yield data are in each of these yield data points. Again, with the nitrogen application rate in the background, we can nicely see the impact that nitrogen application caused first on and that was reflected with NDVI and also on wheat yield. We also took measurements of leaf area index, and they also fell on top or showed really a nice spatial association between leaf area index and wheat yield, and so did plant height measurements. And even if we go to a smaller scale, so we generated smaller cells and analyzed NDVI and wheat yield data here for 10 meter by 4.5 meter cells, the relation was clearly obvious. And we could have done this exercise for much smaller resolution scales and then identify how does the answer change. So what is the conclusion of this study? What are the factors causing non-unique response? Well, that's what we ask ourselves all the time, if results are non-significant. But here we have still the spatial domain. We pay attention to local coordinates, so we know where we have to dig further and find out what is causing this change of soil quality between the left and right hand part of the field. And we need to evaluate the spatial variance and covariance, for example, with using spatial autocorrelation and cross-correlation. That's done here. The autocorrelation function for nitrogen application rate nicely manifests, of course, that sinusoidal pattern, and so does the NDVI measured in March. The wheat yield also shows it, but there's also clear indication of a trend across that field. The yield versus NDVI cross-correlation function, that function shows, this is the classical correlation coefficient that we pay attention to usually. But here in this case, in the cross-correlation function, we can also consider correlations over certain lag distances, and that way we can tell over a distance of 5 lags, which is about 5 times 15 meters, 75 meters, yield measurements are still related to NDVI measurements. So we should not separate observations farther than that. Another approach can be Fourier analysis. We can analyze every data series with respect to the amplitude of the sine wave and the length of the sine wave, which is called period, and that is the inverse of the frequency. And that is nothing else than decomposing. Well, you know from ANOVA, we decompose variance into blocks and effect treatment and interaction and so on. And here we decompose the variance into individual frequencies. And with Fourier, we can assume that any continuous single-valued function can be represented as by a series of sinusoids. Here's a spectral analysis for nitrogen application rate, and of course, because we induced it, so there's a clear variance peak at a frequency of 1 over 10, which refers to a length of 10 plots. That is the length of one sine wave, 10 different plots with nitrogen applications. And we also get a peak at for the wheat yield at the same frequency, and so for the NDVI. Nevertheless, for yield and NDVI, we get also signals at other frequencies. Here, in the left part of this spectrum, we see the long wave signals. So this one is actually showing that there's a large-scale variance component, which was obvious from the data. We can also analyze two variables with and their corresponding frequencies. So wheat yield and NDVI have a clear coinciding variance at this period of 10 waves. Of course, that was induced, and I did that on purpose. I just wanted to state this as an example here, but you can also analyze variance where the effect is not that clear with these spectral techniques. And you can finally use the measured variables yield NDVI and leaf area index in an autoregressive state space model, and here we get a fairly narrow confidence of estimation the yield variation across that field. Why did I tell you this? Why would we use continuous instead of random designs for experiments in farmers' fields? Imagine again the sinusoidal pattern of a treatment. And now we add a systematic underlying process. For example, change in soil quality or management history. That might cause a differing response to what we were expecting here. So the amplitude of the response decreased, and there was also a general increase in the response. If we had had randomized plots, we would have had a difficult time to understand this as this change in response. But since we are dealing with continuous changes, we have much more certainty in understanding visually and analytically what is going on. So random distribution would have been prohibitive in this case in the diagnosis. Conclusions. We do not avoid, but we take advantage of spatial and temporal variability. Spatial and temporal relations can well be diagnosed based on the covariance structure and quantitatively applied in models. Treatments are not necessary, but on the other hand are not prohibitive, so we still can conduct experiments with treatments. Management can cause typical spatial variance structure changes, as Scott Flynn will show this afternoon in his talk. Imposing cyclic patterns of application rates, like I showed it here for the nitrogen, is by far not the end. Apply two different inputs at varying wavelengths, and it will be an intriguing result to see at what combinations of treatments the switches that Mother Nature sets for us turn either on or off. Indicative state variables measured at the land surface allow estimating patterns of important ecosystem processes. And rates of changes can become important state variables for ecosystem stratification. What I did not show Changes in the NDVI were even more closer related to the yield variability in this field experiment. Changes of NDVI over time. How do we begin? Well, first of all, we need to ask a question that does not need to be answered with a range of replicated and randomized treatments. How does sampling distance affect the result that is observed? And over what spatial distances can two sets of observations be taken and they are still related? How stable are spatial patterns in time, and what causes a change in temporal stability? And going back to the first few slides on the respiration rate data or hydraulic conductivity functions, how are kinetic rate coefficients derived from time series distributed in space, and what are the underlying processes that cause this change of kinetic coefficients in space? That is a very challenging question for landscape classification. And with that, I'd like to acknowledge my teacher, Donald Nielsen, and my colleagues, Norbert Wippler, Lloyd Murdoch, John James, James Dollarhide, Charles Dougherty, the farmer, Trevor Gilkey in Princeton, Kentucky, and the Kentucky Small Grain Growers Association and the German Research Foundation. And with that, I thank you very much for your attention. Did everybody understand that question? How does the area over which plant yield is measured, how does that affect the semivariance? That's a very good question, and I can only state from the example of soil water content measurements that the larger the area becomes, in fact, we analyzed it also for yield data, the larger the area becomes, the smaller is the variance, and the smaller are the differences between neighboring observations. And that is not, there's not a black or white answer to it. I think to study that and to demonstrate how the information changes, how the mean changes, and also with that yield, how the yield relation to another underlying important factor changes, that is the important thing you want to find out. So that is basically a research question itself. For example, if you want to relate yield to soil texture, usually we measure yields over much, much larger areas than we can obtain a soil textural sample for. That is often only a point measurement or a measurement from a few points, and then we assume, well, these few points and that one lab analysis represents an area, a pixel or a voxel for the yield measurements. And that is what has to be identified with that cross-correlation analysis. Is that soil textural volume, is that sufficient to be related to the yield measurement that is taken over a larger area or over smaller units? What is the ideal combination of area over which I measure yield and soil texture? And that is only one pair of possible combinations. Transpiration rate and yield may be a much more intriguing question.
There are theoretical reasons on that. It's essentially the idea of variance between versus variance within.
Yes.
As one increases, every increases. Mm-hmm. It's a well-known old problem occurring originally in mining, where they tended to do the native cores, which were relatively small volume, but they wanted to make predictions of the volume.
Tends to what, please?
Increase.
Mm-hmm.
Isabel Clark wrote a book, Practical Geostatistics, which lists the volume of various relationships.
Yeah.
Yes, of course. The ultimate.
The classic geostatistics are more descriptive that there is a correlation, there is a change in variance over time.
Well, in the geostatistics and time series analysis, it is not often mentioned how certain an autocorrelation coefficient is, or how certain a semi-variance, an experimental semi-variance value is. But there's, of course, a statistics behind every of these coefficients. So there is a way of calculating confidence ranges, confidence limits for an autocorrelation coefficient that can be done, as well as you can calculate a confidence into a semi-variance. There's a clear F-statistics definition also for spectra, so you can identify what of the spectra shown in the power spectrum, which of those spectra are significant and which are not. And that depends on the smoothing of the data and various other factors. I do not want to mix that up with autoregressive coefficients. So the coefficient itself describes the magnitude of the spatial relation from one observation to another. That has nothing to do with the certainty of it. That is just the magnitude of the relation. For example, also that coefficient in the equation for respiration as a function of temperature and soil water content. Those coefficients are physically based. But there is a way to calculate the confidence, or the 95% confidence limits of those coefficients. I did not do that here, but it can be done.